Good evening, gladdies and poddies and my newly discovered tweethearts. Spinoza, fascinating fellow. He was, in my view, the best and brightest of the philosophers, the most prescient. He was excommunicated by his fellow Jews, despised and feared by many Christians. And as you'll hear tonight, in a strange way, he was befriended by one Nazi. It's a saga. We're also going to look at the new BRIC bank, and this is the argument that the so-called BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, with South Africa tagging on the end, could and should have their own world bank, because they're a bit irritated by the dominance of the United States and at the IMF by the domination of Europe. And I'll be talking to a couple of distinguished chaps very shortly. But first, I couldn't let the evening pass without acknowledging the resignation of Bob Brown. I have always regarded Bob as one of the greatest politicians in Australian history. And today, in my newfound role as a tweeter, I was trying to explain that he is not only significant here, but internationally. That Bob can claim, not that he does, but others can make the claim for him, that he began the whole process of environmentalism in political party terms. Now, there was an immediate Twitter response protesting this, saying that the Germans did it first, and I was able to tweet back that on this very program I heard from the own personal lips of Petra Kelly, founder of the German Greens, that yes, Bob was her inspiration, and that yes, it was he who first found a way of giving environmental issues political party form. And then I went on to suddenly remember that Petra, of course, left politics in a rather unhappy way, whereas Bob seems to be leaving it on pretty good terms. Petra was murdered in her bed by her boyfriend, who was an ex-general and also a Green politician. Not that that's got anything to do with you, Bob. But, Bob, you've done a great job and you'll be greatly, greatly missed. The BRIC nations are the emerging economies, and they've just had a summit in New Delhi. We're creating their own development bank as an alternative to the World Bank was the hottest of hot topics. There's been a lot of media coverage of this internationally as the US and European financial power brokers sense a shift in the status quo. Now, Prem Shankar Jha wrote about it for the Hindu newspaper, which is one of India's most eminent journals of record. Prem's a former editor of the Hindustan Times and author of many books on global affairs, and he can currently be found in New York, where he's a visiting fellow at the New School University's India-China Institute. And I'll be talking to Prem shortly. And because Jeremy Warner at the last minute was unable to join us live, I recorded this chat with him an hour ago. Jeremy is the assistant editor of the Telegraph newspaper. He's also a prominent business and economics commentator in the UK, and he joins us from what I've no doubt is the plush, lush studio of the Telegraph in London. Jeremy, you've written very sceptically about the BRICS' ability to operate as a unified group, or even the need for a new bank, and we'll come to that in a bit. First of all, can you fill us in on the lead-up to this separate bank idea? I understand it comes from sour grapes, in a sense.
Well, yes, up to a point. There was a summit of BRICS recently, and they decided that they wanted to set up their own alternative development bank. This was in the belief that the job of president of the World Bank, the existing Bretton Woods institution, was going to go to American, which seems highly likely. I mean, we'll hear about that later today. The IMF job has already gone to a European. Traditionally, these two jobs have been shared between Americans and Europeans. The BRICS want their a bigger voice in the world. They believe these institutions are important instruments of geopolitical power. They'd like to hold at least one of them.
You've made the point that Asia and the Soviet didn't count, as these were largely closed economies, therefore of marginal significance for world trade. But with China, India and now Russia adopting free market reforms, they also want to throw their weight around.
Indeed. I mean, when these institutions were set up immediately after the Second World War, Europe and America were in reality the world economy. Asia was a largely closed bloc, as you say, and the Soviet Union was certainly completely closed. These, over the last 20 to 30 years, these economies have come into the global economic system. Increasingly, they're now getting on for 50% of the world economy, if not more. They're a new voice on the world stage. The institutions have not really evolved to reflect that new voice on the world stage.
Well, we've got Obama insisting that he's not about to relinquish his, quote, right to appoint the next president of the World Bank. We've got the euro in deep trouble. We've had the ignominious fall of Dominic Strauss-Kahn. So in a sense, the BRICS timing is interesting.
It is indeed, and they did put they have put up a couple of very credible candidates this time. There's the present Nigerian finance minister, who herself is a former director of the World Bank, and there was Jose Antonio Ocampo from Colombia, who has withdrawn his candidature in order to stop the developing world's vote being split, so it can now be focused on entirely on the Nigerian finance minister. But again, it would be a major surprise if the Americans didn't get their own way. They've put forward Jim Yong Kim, who is a Korean by origin, but in all other respects, an all-American boy.
Jeremy, you're a bit of a heretic in this area, because not only do you not see the BRIC Bank as the best idea you've ever heard, but you don't see the point of the World Bank either.
Increasingly, no, I don't, because for two reasons. One is when you look at where the big surpluses of savings are now, they tend to be in the developing world, China in particular, and a number of other surplus economies in the developing world, not in the Western world any longer. Access to private finance, which used to be a major problem for the developing world, is now not so much of a problem, although it can still, particularly for particularly underdeveloped economies, be a problem in extreme recessionary conditions. But on the whole, it's not really a problem any longer. The World Bank itself has in the past tended to be viewed as something of an ideological organization that very much carried the American capitalist model into the developing world. That too is not such an accepted orthodoxy as it used to be.
Jeremy, I must say that Jimmy Wolfenson, an Australian, former president of the World Bank, didn't do a bad job fine-tuning it.
Yeah, I think that's right. The World Bank has evolved. I mean, it used to be seen as an institution that lent money to corrupt dictators for environmentally dodgy projects like big dams and so on and so forth. And he went a long way towards reforming that image. And there was a little bit of a renaissance, as you say, under him. I'm not saying it should be abolished completely. I'm just saying it's not as relevant as it was. I wouldn't say that about the IMF. The IMF is an absolutely vital global organization. It's a lender of last resort to countries when they get into financing difficulties. It's also a global policeman in terms of economic policy, where economies are heading, and so on and so forth. The World Bank, however, is just a conduit for finance, and there are plenty of alternatives to it these days.
And, of course, since the financial crisis, the developing world is increasing lending to the developed world.
Indeed, that's that's the case. I mean, one of the ironies of the present situation with the euro crisis is that Christine Lagarde, managing director of the IMF, is going cap in hand to the developing world for new funds in order to bail out the eurozone countries. I mean, there couldn't be a greater irony. One of the world's richest regions, if not the richest, Europe, going cap in hand to some of the poorest countries in the world for bailout funds.
You write that outside endemic corruption, uncertain or wholly absent rule of law, and relatively low per capita income and life expectancy, there wouldn't appear to be much that unites this disparate collection of nations.
No, unless it be a sort of vague sense of anti-Western feeling and a belief sometimes justified that the West is sort of out to oppress the developing world in some shape or form. I'm not sure how much of a runner that idea is any longer. And I've observed some of these meetings of BRICS, some of these summits of BRICS at close quarters, and they're not particularly edifying sights. I have to say they are pretty incoherent in the message that they deliver, and
they are consistent in chanting, "We mustn't let the West trample all over us."
Oh, that's for sure. That is the consistent message. And they say that by day while sort of conspiring against each other by night, often in conjunction with the advanced economies who they claim as their oppressors.
Talking to Jeremy Warner, and at this latest New Delhi meeting of BRICS countries, a Delhi declaration was drafted, and it seems to contain not only the most comprehensive criticism of the failures of the West that's been voiced by any group of countries since the end of the Cold War, but it does outline, at least the outline, of an alternative blueprint.
Yes, I don't deny that there is a powerful voice emerging on the world stage which does need to be taken account of. But I would suggest that the way of dealing with this is for the established organisations of the IMF and the World Bank to reform themselves. I mean, we have a meeting of the IMF coming up this week. One of the things that the BRICS will be doing is asking for more votes in return for coughing up more money to bail out the eurozone and so on and so forth. I would say that was an entirely healthy development.
Jeremy, is there any chance that what we're witnessing is an ambit claim, the sort of tactic that the trade union movement used to use in negotiations when it would ask for the sun and the stars, when it was quite willing to accept the clouds? In other words, perhaps the BRICS bank idea isn't utterly serious, but a negotiating weapon.
You may well be right, yes. I think that fundamentally what they are looking for is reform and not revolution. You know, there may be some kind of a case for an alternative development bank, but I suspect that when push comes to shove, it's going to be very difficult for them to agree a structure which will suit them all. There are bound to be quarrels about which development projects that they back and so on and so forth. I'm very sceptical about it, to be honest.
But at the same time, you see that BRICS can potentially achieve a lot together without a bank.
Well, they are achieving a lot individually. Quite what unites them at this stage is quite hard to discern,
but
that they are all high-growth economies.
But are there not some bilateral agreements that come out of BRICS meetings?
There certainly are, and one of the phenomenon which needs to be taken very seriously is that they are beginning to trade one with another much more effectively than they have in the past. In the past, if there was a recession in the West, the developing economies would be clobbered two or three times over because they relied on the West basically to support their economies. That's not nearly so much the case any longer. The trade between the BRICS is now beginning to exceed the trade with the developing world. And that's very much a new phenomena, and it is something which can't be ignored.
So is there at least a chill of fear passing through the old guard?
Well, if there is, I don't see why there should be. It's obviously in everybody's interest that all economies grow, take people out of poverty, generate prosperity. So in itself, there's nothing the West has to fear from this phenomenon. There's only opportunity within it.
That was the voice of Jeremy Warner talking to us from London. Jeremy, the assistant editor of The Telegraph. And now let's whiz from London to New York to bring you, as promised, Prem Shankar Jha. And Prem, would you take the story from here? The BRICS are rebelling. The rebellion promises or threatens a new bank. What do you think?
I think one shouldn't look at this purely in economic terms. The idea of a bank, particularly just a development bank, sort of a parallel to the World Bank or the regional international banks, is really not. I mean, banks have to do various things; they have many functions. But this is not the most important thing that has to be done. For one thing, none of the five countries, certainly none of the four, the BRIC countries, actually need funding or backing, financial backing for doing their work, develop projects, etc. I mean, China has $3 trillion worth of reserves. India has $350 billion. Russia has got large reserves. And Brazil's are rising very rapidly. So it's not that they need to – they don't need another bank because they're not getting – time from, or they even need a World Bank. And that I agree with Jeremy, that the World Bank to some extent has lost its original rationale. Well, actually, not the original rationale was reconstruction, but even the developmental rationale, except for the lowest income countries, and that's another story. The BRICS are mainly being motivated by political changes in the world.
You heard Jeremy being rather rude about the things in common between the BRICS nations, but it's surely not as bleak or as shabby as that.
I think that Jeremy misses out one very, very important thing, which is that it's not what we have in common with each other, in the sense of the things that join us, but the things that we are against. What is bringing BRICS together is the way that the West is trying to evolve a world, which doesn't, in fact, make sense to me, but to make sense to most people in the non policy making circles of the EU and the US. The BRICS were very clear about this. In fact, I think this is much more a political statement, and a political statement backed with economic teeth, which have yet to be developed.
Well, Prem, what we have is a sort of a white supremacist model of world, financial governance, don't we?
That's actually one of the problems. But in fact, it's not a white. The financial and economic white supremacy is not the central issue. I don't think that that's bothered India very much in the past. It's beginning to bother us now because the Western governments are using the banks to throttle countries that they don't approve of, often on grounds that we don't agree with. Take Iran, for example. India is determined to continue trading oil with Iran. The question is, it's been every conceivable kind of obstacle has been put in its way. For instance, for transferring money, we can't. The international banking system said we won't do it. So this is the kind of thing. Libya was financially strangled, and its money has been sequestered and remains sequestered till this day. This is becoming a sort of a technique of control, which is not acceptable to most of the world, it is most certainly not acceptable to BRICS.
Would you tell me the origin of
the idea of an alternate bank? There's more than enough money in these countries to fund that bank.
Well, China could fund it on its own, couldn't it?
On its own, of course. Yeah. But China doesn't want to fund it on its own because then it becomes too much of a political thing. Remember when they went and offered $100 billion to the European Union? They also tagged a whole series of political conditions on it, which made the EU reject it out of hand.
Would you be kind enough to tell me the essence of the Delhi Declaration?
Yes, I think the essence of the Delhi Declaration is political, and it is contained in 6 points, actually, slightly more than 6 paragraphs. And it starts with a critique of European and, by implication, American monetary mismanagement, which has plunged both continents into irredeemable national debt. The second is a very sharp, equally sharp critique of the West's political mismanagement of the Middle East, starting with Libya. A third paragraph reminds us that peace in the Middle East cannot be obtained without comprehensive and long-lasting settlement of the Arab-Israeli dispute. That's a quote, by the way. So it's rightly, I think, to my mind, sees that the origins of all trouble in the Middle East is the sort of the continuously simmering cauldron of trouble on Israel-Arab issue.
Prem, I understand there's also an unequivocal reassertion of the need to respect the sovereignty, independence,
yes, I
and
just
territorial
coming to that. The next
integrity.
2 points. Yeah. That point has been made in the context of Syria, and it has been made very, very sharply, I mean, with absolutely no ambiguity left. And finally, it is Iran. And in Iran, it says the situation in Iran must not be allowed to escalate into a conflict. Must not be allowed. And that's pretty strong words. So it's really, I think that these are the points that we have to look at. We are seeing a kind of reckless militarism at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm telling you from my point of view. You're welcome to disagree with me if you like.
Prem, I don't disagree with you in the slightest. But I'm curious about the views on Syria. What was the view from Delhi of the crisis in Syria?
Well, we've had 15, unlike Western journalists, we've had 15 journalists who've been there at various times and who've all written our papers. I myself have remained in touch with various people in Damascus because I used to live there 40 years ago. And the picture that they present to me is very, very different. First, they say that, and for this there's dates that I've written a whole article on this elsewhere, beginning from March 26th, Assad systematically dismantled the authoritarian state. The referendum and the new constitution were the last steps in the dismantling, and they were preceded 6 weeks earlier by an offer of a general amnesty to everybody with a request, just stop fighting. No, lay down your arms, don't surrender arms. Just stop fighting and take part in the referendum. You can have what you want. The constitution itself, which has now been accepted and is going enacted and requires an election in 3 months, says that no one with a foreign-born wife can be president of Syria, which means from 2014, Bashar Assad has ruled himself out. He could not be more explicit. Mm. There's no way of being directly explicit except beyond this. Now, all we are saying is give it a chance. I have had 28 years of experience of covering insurgencies in Punjab and Kashmir, and I've seen how easy it is. In fact, the chosen technique for provoking insurgencies is fire on policemen, get them to return fire, civilians get killed, and then after that, there's a wave of anger.
Easy to start and hard to stop, isn't it?
It had to stop. In Syria, there are 20. Syrians claim, the government claims, that 2,100 soldiers and 600 policemen have been killed. And they have all their names. They've had to notify the families, pay out compensations. There are lists, exactly as there were lists of people dead in Iraq and in the U.S. Some of our journalists were shown those lists. They've talked to the Grand Mufti of Syria, who's the head of the Sunni party, talked to the Bishop of Antioch. They've talked to a variety of people who all are worried about, their biggest worry is that this conflict, which is being fueled from outside, they say, is tearing apart the social fabric. Here is a country where we now start talking about Sunnis and Shias, but they didn't talk about it for 45 years. When I was last there, I've been there in 2008 and 2010, very briefly, the first thing that struck me is that in contrast to even Turkey, which I know very well because I lived there for 4 years, the sense of a secular government which is on its back foot and somewhat under siege, and very strongly I used to feel that in Egypt also, that is simply not there in Syria. You have a national symphony orchestra. It has European performers all the time. It has gala performances. The president of the republic is the patron. He goes there. He participates in it. This is a very different kind of country from Islamist countries that are developing now all over the Middle East. Why on earth should we not give them a chance to go through the whole political process that Assad has started and which is being systematically rejected by simply using violence by the other side?
I have to say that's the most eloquent defense of the Syrians I've heard from any quarter, and I thank you very much for talking to me and to Australia. Prem Shankar Jha, journalist, author, that's understating it by orders of magnitude, and he's currently writing a book on the international political and economic order after globalization. That's the end of our BRIC story, and now we're going to switch quite dramatically to Spinoza, one of the most profoundly creative philosophers in human history. And what you're going to hear is a very, very strange story.